You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a sports writer joins the show to talk about what it was like being hospitalized with COVID-19 and why he wants his fellow Wisconsinites to take the virus seriously. Now, President Biden signed a flurry of executive orders on his first day in office. As part of his early actions, he revoked the Keystone XL pipeline permit. The 1,200-mile-long pipeline that would have carried oil from Canada to the Gulf Coast had yet to be built, but has been thoroughly politicized. Our next guest has been covering what this cancellation means for the future of the oil industry and America's relations with Canada. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your reactions to this decision from the Biden administration? What questions do you have about the Keystone XL pipeline? Should we cancel pipelines, focus more on renewable energy? Are you worried about the impact that the cancellation could have on jobs? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ben LaFave is the energy reporter for Politico. He's covered the energy industry and policy for nearly a decade. Ben, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, we've seen this back and forth over presidential administrations until this decision from Biden. What was the current state of affairs for the pipeline?
It had been given the green light by the Trump administration back in 2017. But even then, it still never really got off the ground. It had been tied up in court cases for the past, 3.5 years. There was an attempt to kind of get some of it built at the border. That didn't go very far. And then we had, as you mentioned, when President Biden took office, one of his first acts was basically to put the stake through the heart of it.
What were the arguments from Biden and his team about why they made this decision?
From a political standpoint, or their standpoint, it was that the pipeline, if built, would have promoted energy production in Canada, or basically led to more oil production in Western Canada out of the oil sands area over there. And the Western Canadian oil sands is a particularly kind of nasty kind of crude. You don't pump it out of the ground. You basically have to dig up out of the ground and treat it to, get it into a state where you can throw it into a pipeline. But with that said, they thought it would have promoted more greenhouse gas emissions and would have made climate change worse. And therefore, it was not in the best interest of the U.S. to have this pipeline built.
Wisconsin's Republicans in the U.S. House reacted to the decision, not happy about it. I want to give a listen to Wisconsin Representative Brian Stile talking, I think, on Fox over the weekend.
On Joe Biden's first day in office, he killed thousands of American jobs. Joe Biden killed hundreds of Wisconsin jobs. On Joe Biden's first day in office, hundreds of Wisconsin workers got laid off of their job building private sector infrastructure. Joe Biden needs to reconsider his decision immediately.
Wisconsin Representative Brian Stile speaking at a press conference, actually. What do we know about the job impact of this decision, Ben?
The job impact, reminds me of the old saying, there's, lies, damn lies, and then there's statistics. Getting a number on the jobs is basically, you really need to define what you're talking about when you mean jobs. Company behind Keystone, TC Energy, said it was going to lay off 1,000 people because of this decision. The State Department, when it did a review of the project, I think it was back in 2014, they estimated there'd be several thousand jobs created, but they would be temporary construction jobs. Now, given, even a construction job that lasts for several months or maybe a year, you still don't like to lose it. This wasn't going to be a permanent employer of hundreds of people pretty much anywhere. I made sure to look this up before we went on the air. And according to that report, I think there was going to be like maybe 100, 150, if that, full-time permanent employees of from this pipeline. The construction jobs would have been a bigger deal, But it's hard to get a handle on how many construction jobs may have been created, especially given that the pipeline was never fully under construction in the first place.
Talking to Ben Lefebvre from Politico, energy reporter there, looking at the Biden administration's decision to cancel a key permit for the Keystone XL pipeline. Before we go to our callers at 800-642-1234, Ben, does this mean it's the end of the line? This is pretty much not going to happen?
Yeah. You know, it's kind of interesting. This pipeline was first proposed in 2008. And at that time, you know, U.S. oil production was still, you know, it was seen as like almost minimal. I mean, there was, you know, real concern that the U.S. was going to run out of oil and we needed to bring in more imports. So, you know, TC Energy at that time, known as TransCanada, came in and said, well, let's build this big pipeline to bring oil from Canada into the U.S. But, you know, we had this oil boom, you know, and, you know, maybe even 4 or 5 years ago, there's been so much oil being produced out of the U.S. that even when Trump signed the executive order kind of giving Keystone XL a green light, the market kind of had moved on by that point. When TC Energy first proposed this pipeline and U.S. oil production was 5 million barrels a day, last year it was 12 million barrels a day. And most energy companies thought, we don't really need to bring in that much more oil from other sources. So now that Biden has killed it this time, I don't see where any, you know, even if Biden's out in 4 years and there's a new Republican administration, there's no real need to have Keystone, you know, brought back from the dead.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Brad is with us in Fall Creek. Brad, hi.
Hi. The reason I called is I actually worked in the oil field. I worked in Wyoming and Utah and Texas, roughnecking and working on pipeline or as casing crews. That Keystone pipeline, which no one ever reports, is not just Canadian oil, because most of our oil that's drilled in the United States is drilled by foreign companies. That's to take our oil and ship it overseas. It would go to a refinery in Galveston, Texas, and I've personally spoken to people that work there. It's 48% owned by Saudi Arabia. This is why we will never see oil independence in the United States, because people don't go to the source. They don't realize that a lot of even our mines are owned by foreign companies.
Brad, thanks a lot for the call. Ben, if this had reached the Gulf Coast, would some of that Canadian oil ended up just being shipped out?
Oh, undoubtedly. I mean, that was another big thing that, and I'm glad the caller brought this up. I mean, one of Canada's problems is that their oil fields are basically landlocked. And to realize as much money as they can, they need to get this oil to markets where it can be, you know, where people want it. The U.S., as I mentioned before, has been producing so much of its own oil that there's not that much room left for Canadian crude. What TransCanada really wants to do is get that oil to the coast. And there's been talks of, you know, that a lot of it would have gone to the Gulf Coast. And as your caller mentioned, probably would have been put on ships overseas. I mean, most of the new oil coming into the U.S., either out of U.S. oil fields or, you know, from Canada, ends up going overseas because U.S. fuel demand is pretty much flat. Our refiners don't need that much more oil for domestic use. What they do like to have is, you know, a few more barrels that they can then, you know, either put on a crude ship to ship overseas to China or wherever, you know, wherever, or to refine it into gasoline or to other fuel products that they then put on a ship and ship overseas.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Ben Lefebvre, energy reporter for Politico, looking at the Biden administration's plans for energy, including the cancellation of the permit for the Keystone XL pipeline. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the Keystone XL pipeline cancellation? And do you have a question about the future of American energy? Call 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Politico energy reporter Ben LaFave about the politics and practicality of new oil pipelines. On President Biden's first day in office, he canceled the permit for the proposed Keystone XL pipeline. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions and your reactions. 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Vernon County. Jim, hi.
Hello. Thanks for having me on. I wanted to ask your guest if he knew if Joe Biden had an idea of what to do with the 11,000 union employees who will be without a job.
Jim, thanks for the call. There's the debate over how many jobs this affects, but that's, and we've heard this from Canadian leaders too, that, hey, these are good jobs that we're losing out on, Ben.
Yeah, as I mentioned before, I keep calling by their old name, TC Energy said in an internal email that we reported on, it'd be about 1,000 workers who they were going to lay off. Again, it's really hard to tell the numbers. I live in an area where I walk my school kids to school every day, and there were a number of months we had a natural gas pipeline being built, along their way to school. And you could see how many guys were working on it, but, you know, you'd have a group come in, level the ground, you know, they'd go away, a group come in, dig the trench, they'd go away, a group come in, put in the pipe, and they'd go away, and another group, you know, bury it back up. These jobs that are being mentioned, they're temporary jobs, and construction workers will go from one project to the next. Now, obviously, you're not going to have Keystone XL to work on, and therefore, they're going to lose out on that. But it's not like, you know, these guys are going to go not, you know, other projects will be coming in. And what Biden has done, what I thought was interesting, when he unveiled his energy plan, it was basically a jobs plan, you know, what they say they want to do, but with the title energy plan on it. So they want to bring back, for instance, or they want to add union jobs to help plug up, you know, all the old oil wells that are, you know, that companies hadn't plugged up, even though they're not pumping any more oil out of them. They wanted to add union jobs for other renewable energy projects. So the Biden administration seems to be betting that they can kind of jumpstart renewable energy projects or fossil fuel cleanup projects using union jobs in a hope that they can kind of like, you know, I don't want to say paper over, but, you know, try to, you know, if you take away some with one hand, add some more jobs with the other hand.
Thanks a lot for that call. Let's go to Gloria now in Madison. Gloria, hi.
Thank you for having this. This is a great show. The fact that the XL, would that be the reservation people, the Native Americans will be real happy on this. And the other thing is, with the solar panels that we have, would that be a reason that we are decreasing the amount of oil because we are putting up so many solar panels on homes?
Thanks for the call. Ben, you wrote about kind of tough times for gas and natural gas and oil over the last 4 years and a growth time for alternative energies. What are we seeing?
Yeah, and I just want to, you know, go back to what the caller first brought up. This just wasn't environmental groups who were not happy with Keystone. This was also landowners, like in some states, who were upset about the eminent domain use that the developer used. And that's, you know, if you don't know what eminent domain is, but basically saying our pipeline project takes precedence over your private land owning, and therefore, you know, we're going, even if you don't want to allow us to use, you know, your property to build this pipeline, we're going to use eminent domain and say it's for the, you know, it's for the best if we are able to use it anyway. And so there were landowners and Native American tribes who were you know, having their land used to build a pipeline. And, you know, some of them wanted it, some of them didn't. As far as solar panels and why oil demand is, you know, kind of flatlined in the U.S., for a number of years, it's just, you know, as cars get more efficient, as energy usage gets more efficient, there's no need to keep bringing on or to keep using more oil. And that's why, you know, as the U.S. oil production has increased every year for the past decade or so, you know, the barrels that are, you know, the additional barrels being produced are going on ships and going overseas, which has been great for the U.S., you know, taxpayer. It's, you know, you get revenue out of that. But it's not like the oil itself is needed in the U.S. And that was another reason why, you know, like I said, the market had kind of moved on from Keystone. As far as renewable energy, yeah, that's also, you know, that's been like a real kind of sleeper story for the past several years, where a lot of utilities who had may have been using coal for, or even natural gas to a certain extent, to generate electricity, have been turning to wind power and solar power just because it's just gotten so cheap. I mean, I used to live in Houston for a while, and there were days where we would hear that there was so much wind power being produced in some areas that prices would go negative, that basically they, you know, if you were lucky enough to have a utility that was using wind power, that they were getting too much. Now, that doesn't happen all over the place, and there's still problems with getting these renewable energy projects, you know, connected to the grid. But, you know, this is another reason why even natural gas is sort of starting, you know, people in the natural gas industry are starting to get worried that, you know, gee, natural gas kicked coal out of the utility, you know, generation. But now they're having to worry about renewables and battery power.
Thanks a lot for that call. In our last half minute or so, Ben, what's the next energy story you have your eye on?
We're wondering, you know, Keystone was all, you know, obviously the big one, but we're starting to wonder if there are going to be some other pipeline projects that may be, you know, taking another look at. The Trump administration was great at green lighting some projects. They were not so great at following through with it. So some of these projects they gave the okay to were legally kind of shaky and, you know, were under, you know, kind of court challenges. And we're now wondering if the Biden administration is going to say, we're just not going to defend this case anymore that the Trump administration may have, you know, brought about. So we're wondering to see if the Dakota Access Pipeline may be also under fire in the next week or so.
Ben, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Ben LaFave is an energy reporter at Politico. He covers the energy industry. He talked to us today about President Biden revoking a key permit for the Keystone XL pipeline. Today, for the first time, Wisconsin will begin vaccinating adults who are 65 years old and older against COVID-19. That will greatly expand who's eligible for the vaccine here and could complicate the process. So far, the vaccine's rollout has drawn criticism from some lawmakers, healthcare workers, and some frustrated residents. Shemaine Mills reports.
The pace of vaccinations against COVID-19 in the country have been slow. Compared to the speed in which vaccines were made and approved, it seems downright sluggish. In the week before his inauguration, Joe Biden said as much.
The vaccine rollout in the United States has been a dismal failure thus far.
Biden has set an ambitious goal, 100 million shots in 100 days. To reach that level, states like Wisconsin would need a lot more vaccine than they've gotten so far, not to mention a workable plan to get shots into arms. Some feel the state's off to a rocky start. About 5% of the population has been vaccinated so far. GOP Assembly Health Chairman Joe Sanfilippo criticized the Evers administration, which is focused on getting shots to healthcare workers and in nursing homes while urging others to be patient.
For us to, you know, to wait till July to be able to get to the general public is just, you know, that's not fast enough.
Across the U.S., less than half the 38 million doses distributed have actually been used. Many are still sitting on shelves. Some states are doing better than others. North Dakota, for instance, is vaccinating at twice the rate Wisconsin is, and West Virginia leads the U.S. in vaccinating nursing homes. Even with broad guidance from the state on who can currently get a shot, individual cases can present tricky dilemmas. Take Rita Baker, who recently contacted WPR's Wisconsin Project. Baker, a retired teacher who taught German to high schoolers in Connecticut, has temporarily moved to Madison.
Ich heiße Rita Baker. Ich komme aus Connecticut. Ich fahre morgen nach Wisconsin.
Baker is staying with her daughter and son-in-law, where she cares for her first grandchild, while the child's parents work.
With the pandemic, nobody felt comfortable sending the baby to daycare. He's just 2 months old at the time. And so my husband and I drove 15 hours to Madison, and I became a granny nanny.
The 67-year-old has pulmonary sarcoidosis, an autoimmune disease that affects the lungs. As the state opens vaccinations up to those 65 and older, a state board hasn't recommended prioritizing those with chronic health conditions. She'll qualify, though, because of her age. As of mid-January, doctors at community clinics around the state still hadn't been vaccinated. These are the doctors who treat lower-income patients. Many of them work with populations that are at high risk of serious complications from the virus. As community clinic staff get their shots, they also have to plan how to vaccinate patients with fragile vaccines that have very specific storage requirements and have to be used within 6 hours of opening. Dr. Allison Koss is with Progressive Community Health Center in Milwaukee.
Obviously, it can lead to restricting how many people you can schedule for vaccination, hoping that they come. And then in the event that they no-show for their vaccination, how do you scramble or how do you best use the doses that are left over so that you prevent waste?
States don't want to waste doses, and they don't have time to waste. A new, more contagious strain of COVID is circulating in the U.S., which threatens to worsen the pandemic. In order to vaccinate 80% of Wisconsin's population by the end of June, Deputy Health Secretary Julie Willems-Van Dyke says the state would need three times as much vaccine as it's getting now. And while the vaccine supply is expected to be steady in the next month, she said there's no indication it will increase anytime soon. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can find more of our coverage of the COVID-19 pandemic at WPR.org. On a related note, coming up, a Wisconsin sports writer shares his experience battling COVID-19, including what he called the worst 11 days of his life. He shares the story of COVID, hospitalization, and recovery coming up. I'm Rob Ferret. News is next. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we ask you to call in and share your favorite card games, whether it's something you just learned or something you grew up playing. Tell us what card games you like to play and why. Now, more than 500,000 Wisconsinites have been infected with COVID-19. Nearly 5,700 have died from the disease. Even when it's not fatal, fighting off COVID-19 can be a scary experience, one that our next guest went through firsthand. He recently got home from the hospital and wrote about his symptoms and treatment, which included what he calls some of the worst days of his life. Gary D'Amato is a senior writer for Wisconsin.golf, formerly a sports writer with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Gary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's good to be on. Thank you.
Before we get into your story, Gary, I got to ask, how are you feeling today after this ordeal?
I'm feeling, you know, much better than I felt a few weeks ago. That's for sure. I'm on the road to recovery and feeling a little bit better every day. So I'm in a good place.
What made you want to write about and share your experience with COVID-19?
Yeah, that's a good question. I work for a website, Wisconsin.golf, and I posted my last story in mid-December, and then I tested positive on December 20th for COVID, and because I was out of action about a month, my boss has suggested that maybe I do a story that just kind of explains where I've been, so people don't think that I quit or got fired. And the story wound up my old employer, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, wound up contacting my bosses to ask if they could reprint it in the Journal Sentinel, and so that's how it got sort of got out.
And you write, Gary, that in the lead up as COVID-19 was going on, you were where a lot of people were. You wore masks inside in some places. You took maybe some calculated risks, some chances elsewhere. What was on your mind with COVID-19 before it hit you?
Yeah, you know, I was one of those people who I did everything I was supposed to do. I followed the rules, but I also was careless at times, too. I didn't think I'd get sick. And I thought if I did get it, you know, I'd be one of those people who recovered in a few days. I'm in relatively good health. I don't have any underlying issues. And I just took it for granted that if I did get sick, it wouldn't be that bad. And I quite obviously, I was very wrong and learned a lesson the hard way. And this is a hideous virus, and it's sure is not one to be taken lightly.
And you have a plea in your piece. Like you say to people reading this, don't go right to the politics of this, right? You want people to think about the sheer health things going on here and not make it Democrats and Republicans and whatever.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's become a politicized issue, and that's really unfortunate. But when it strikes you the way it struck me, it becomes very personal. And when you're laying in a hospital bed and they're talking about intubation and you can't breathe, you're not... Not one of those thoughts goes through your mind about the politics of it all. You're just sick and you're worried and you're hoping, you know, you're hoping against hope that you get better. So, yeah, I the politics people, I think, should set that aside when it comes to this thing.
Now, take us, Gary, from the early symptoms and the diagnosis to ending up in the hospital.
I started feeling some symptoms on December 19th, and they got a little worse on the 20th. I went in and got rapid tested and tested positive, and the nurse came in and told me, you tested positive, you know, you've got a slight fever, treat it with ibuprofen and Tylenol, and, you know, the odds are pretty good you're going to be okay in a few days. And I went home, and I felt like for about 3 or 4 days, I just felt like I had a little bit of a head cold. That's what it felt like at first. And then I started spiking a fever, and it was going up and down. And when it reached 104 at one point, I went to the ER and was treated for it. Came home and felt pretty good for about a day. And then I started having problems breathing on about December 28th. And when I talk about problems breathing, I mean, it felt like, you know, I think I describe it as having your nostrils closed, pinned shut, and having someone, you know, stick some socks down your throat. I couldn't get any breath in my lungs. And that's why I went back to the hospital and was admitted on the 29th.
We're talking to longtime Wisconsin sports writer Gary D'Amato about his experience with COVID-19. He wrote about it at wisconsingolf.com, reprinted in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Gary, that takes us to what you call the worst 11 days of your life. If you could tell us a little about that, I imagine it's painful to think back on.
Yeah, you know, I've never been sicker in my life, for one thing. I was honestly worried that I wasn't going to make it, that I wasn't going to get out of the hospital. And I was in a bad place for several days. And at one point, when I was on a BiPAP machine, that it's sort of a mechanical ventilator. It's one step before they intubate you. And I wasn't getting any better. They were forcing massive amounts of oxygen, you know, into my lungs. And at one point, the respiratory therapist came in and said, you know, time to talk about, you know, if you don't get better, we might have to intubate you and sedate you. And that's when I really got worried. And thankfully for me, it didn't get to that point. I started to slowly improve over the next couple of days and didn't need to be intubated, but I was close to having to have that done. And I was honestly very, very scared at that point.
You got past it without being intubated. You eventually got out of the hospital. What has recovery been like since then?
It's been really strange. The symptoms are just sort of all over the place. My body has really done some strange things. I mean, for 3 or 4 days after I got home, I was released January 8th, and for 3 or 4 days after that, you know, my heart rate would spike if I just stood up and walked 20 feet. And I had equilibrium problems. It felt like I was going to just tip over. And strangely enough, I had, like, my handwriting was really bad. Like, I didn't have the coordination to, my penmanship was all over the map. I mean, it just did some funny things to me. And I've heard other people say their handwriting got really bad, too. And chronic fatigue, you know, just always tired, naps and I was on all kinds of medications and steroids and everything. So it was just a, it was just all over the place with symptoms for a while.
You wrote you're thankful to be recovering now, in part because you're looking forward to seeing some good golf, COVID permitting, in Wisconsin this year. I don't know if we have those, the tournaments you're looking forward to, things like that. Are you going to look at it with a new appreciation, knowing that there was a shot that you weren't going to make it to see him this year?
Yeah, I'm very excited about being here, for one, but about my job at Wisconsin.golf and getting to cover some really big tournaments in the state this year. Hopefully, as people get vaccinated here, and hopefully the number of cases is going to decline. We're going to get a handle on this pandemic, and we can sort of return to some kind of normal, especially in the golf course, where even last year, in the midst of the pandemic, it was one of the sort of safe things you could do, because social distancing is just inherent in the sport of golf. And all the golf courses passed rules such as don't touch the flag stick. They took rakes out of bunkers. So golf was played pretty safely last year. I know the WSGA, the Wisconsin State Golf Association, held most of its tournaments, and not one case of COVID-19 could be contact traced back to the tournaments. So I'm pretty confident and hopeful that we're going to return to the golf in an almost normal form this summer.
Well, Gary, thanks for sharing your story, and best on a continued recovery.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Gary D'Amato is a senior writer at Wisconsin.golf. He talked with us today about his experience with COVID-19. You can find a link to his piece at WPR.org/Central Time. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to an audience question about a historical football team.
Gene Jansen wrote to Wisconsin about the Little Chute Flying Dutchman, a semi-pro football team that played for 3 decades, a mere 25 miles from Lambeau Field. He remembered the team from his youth and hoped to learn more about its history. With his help, WPR's Jenny Peek hit the archives to learn more.
When Gene Jansen was a boy, he spent many Sunday mornings helping ready the field for the Little Chute Flying Dutchman, his town's very own semi-pro football team.
We'd go to the lumber yard, and that's where we'd get the line and at this machine and put the lines up. And all the yard markers had to be 17 and a half inches in from the sidelines, And it took a long time because you had 50 yards one way and 50 yards going the other way.
That was in the late 1940s, but the team got its start in 1920. Over the years, the Flying Dutchman played teams across central and northeast Wisconsin. And while the Dutchmen were able to suit up as a team for 30 straight years, other teams came and went.
After the war, there was other teams that had not have a team because of the war, took a lot of their players away. Fortunately, in Little Chute, we were able to keep going because the St. John's High School was giving teams that the players could keep playing. And so a lot of those players went on to play for the Flying Dutchman.
So what were some of the teams the Flying Dutchman played?
The main four teams was Manitowoc Gales, the Two Rivers Ramblers, and Little Chute, and the Merrill Foxes. I think it was, believe, in 1938. Later on was the New London Edisons, the Clintonville four-wheeler drive truckers, and the Appleton Reds.
But the Dutchmen didn't just play semi-pro teams. Legend has it they also played the Green Bay Packers.
I was able to trace it to 1920. By talking to some of the guys, I heard it was 52-0 that Little Chute got whomped. However, when you read more, it shows where one of the teams actually beat the Packers. I think it was the 1935, like an exhibition game or something like that. The only one of a semi-pro team that ever beat the Packers.
Jansen says fans of the Little Chute Flying Dutchman even tailgated like the Cheeseheads of today.
When they played ball at halftime, where did some of the crowd go at halftime? Where the heck are those guys going? Well, here they're going across the road, about a block away, and this guy had a garage, and he had beer in that garage with coolers. And those guys would go over there and get a can of beer, And he had his whole garage lined up with all different kinds of beer cans, different brands. I think that's how he got his collection.
The team disbanded in 1950. Jim Bunger, now 91, played toward the end of the Flying Dutchman's reign.
And I played with Dutchman 47, 48, 49. I played tackle and guard most of the time, both ways, on defense and offense.
But like many of his teammates, Bungers had to eventually say goodbye to football.
In 50, I got married. Well, then football was over with for me. Yeah, I couldn't take a chance on getting hurt more or anything after I got married. Oh, I really enjoyed playing the football net. But it's just after you get married that you don't play that anymore.
Now 81, Jansen hopes to pass along some of the history he remembers so fondly.
Like I said, it was crowds like sometimes 3,000 people at the game because, you know, years ago there was no television, you know, and that's how it was. Everybody went to a game. People followed everything. And now it's hard to get people to get involved, even volunteering, you know. It's keep things going that you used to belong to. I love helping people, and I just... this is history that people should know.
You've got to be a football hero to get along with the beautiful girl.
This story came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we want to hear from you. Tell us about your favorite card games. From Sheep's Head to Uno, we want to hear what your favorite card games are and maybe some good memories of playing them as a kid or last night. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Bridge, poker, Sheep's Head, Pinochle, Euchre. Name your game, 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll take your calls and your card game memories coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, human rights abuses have plagued the troubled teen industry for years. Programs like Tough Love Schools make billions, but reform has been slow. Two new storytelling projects look at the price paid by those looking for help. Today at 6 on 1A+. Now, lots of Wisconsinites have some card game traditions, including things like cribbage, euchre, sheep's head, and more. Playing with family around the holidays, maybe at a cabin, maybe with friends on the weekend. But they're all different games, or same games with different names, or games with the same name, but different rules. What do you like to play? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you miss, during the pandemic, card get-togethers? Have you found a way, as I have, to play something online? Call in at 800-642-1234. We'll go right to your calls now. Mike is with us in Oconomowoc. Mike, hi.
Hi. We play Pinochle, two-handed. Three-handed and four-handed pinochle, and I think it's not just a blast to play, but it really it's great for memory. It's great for cognitive thinking, strategy. It's a great game, and I mean, it's something that I learned from my grandparents, so it pulled the whole family together. Just a fun time.
All right, now hang on, Mike. This was the game that started this conversation. This was the huge game in my family, still is, and we just found a website so I can play with my folks in Michigan, my brother in California. Some four-handed, we do some three-handed, going to get my wife in on it. Have you played online at all?
I have not, so this is something I'm definitely going to have to try.
All right, Mike, thank you so much for getting us started at 800-642-1234. Yeah, that is what got me wondering what you all like to play card game-wise. Being able to pick back up on our long family pinochle rivalries by playing online. Let's go to Jeff now in Green Bay. Jeff, hi.
Hi there.
What's your game, Jeff?
King's Corner. Used to play with my grandma and my aunt, and it just brings back memories. Them sitting around drinking brandy and smoking cigarettes, but they're gone, long gone now, but just good memories.
Now, what's King's Corner? I think of King's Corner as a checker game. Is there a card game, King's Corner?
We used to play King's Corner with cards, and I don't even remember how to play.
I gotta look that up, Jeff. Thanks. You set me up with a new one. We are talking about the card games we like to play at 800-642-1234. Let's go to John now in Mount Horeb. John, hi.
Hey, how are you doing?
Pretty good, John. What's your game?
Well, I learned to play euchre from my grandma, and she was born in 1902, so she probably had, you know, 65 years on me. but when I was probably just an 8 or 10 year old, she was always telling me how to play euchre and training me. And one of the days, you know, she said, go look in the house where we were playing. Sometimes we'd play at different aunts and uncles' houses, and she'd say, go look at the way the bathtub runs. And I didn't quite get it. And she'd say, yeah, see if it runs north and south or east and west. And so I'd come back and tell her the direction that the bathtub would run. And she'd say, make sure when we play later today that that's where we sit in the table, so that we sit across from each other the same way the bathtub runs. She always told me we'd have better luck when we did that. So interesting little euchre tradition from back in the day.
I love it, John. Thank you so much. That's a great story, the lucky bathtub alignment in euchre. Yeah, euchre was another big one growing up for me through college. I'll still play euchre every now and then, big in the state, of course. Let's go to Joel now in New Glarus. Joel, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
All right. Well, what's your card game, Joel?
Well, it was already brought up, but euchre is a huge card game in my family.
Yeah, how old are you?
I remember.
Yeah, how old were you when you first learned, Joel?
Oh, I must have been a wee lad, maybe 8 or 10, as soon as I could hold cards.
Excellent.
Well enough. Yeah, we would play that nonstop up till 4 in the morning on our family gatherings. It's just one of those games that I get with my family, and we don't even need to talk or say anything almost. It's just automatic cards flying on the table, and it's just a cool game to play.
I love it, Joel. Thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah, I remember playing with uncles, aunts, cousins, and more. Euchre with my mom's side of the family was bigger, except there are the uncles and aunts of my dad who played double-deck pinochle. Don't even get me started on that. And then pinochle, single-deck on the other side. Thanks for that call. We are taking your favorite card games, past or present, memories, or what you're playing, maybe online, 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Katie is with us in Burlington. Katie, hi.
I was a sucker for this. I had to call in. We just learned about this new game. It's called Five Crowns, and it's so much fun. Like, you have to make, like, three of a kind or four of a kind, and then you have to have runs, and then you get more cards as the game goes on, and then there's a different wild cards in it and stuff. So it's super fun. I just recommend it, like, if people like playing cards and they like doing that, you know, those types of thing, I would just give it a try.
Interesting.
So we love
Five Crowns. I have not encountered that yet, but I'm about to encounter it again, I think. Shona is with us in Hollandale. Shona, hi.
Hi. I was just going to say Five Crowns is one of our favorite games to play.
Now, and our last caller said this was a new game. I don't know if it was new to her or, like, as far as you know, is this like a new invention?
Let's see here. I've got the box here. It doesn't have like a date that it came out.
Okay. Oh, but just, it has a special deck of cards. It's not like with normal playing cards.
Yeah. Well, it's like, I guess what it would be. Well, it's like five decks of like different like hearts. Diamonds, like stars.
Ah, clubs. Stars. That's a new
yeah.
one.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was like you play it like that, and it's really kind of fun because you start out with three cards, and then each round you go up a card, and each round, like whatever number of cards you're holding, that number is the wild card. So
wow.
Then, yeah, so then you have to do the straights, and you have to do like the runs, or
cool.
You know, it's a really fun game, and we played euchre for like years. And then our friends brought this game to our attention, and then we've just been playing this a bunch. It's like gin rummy.
Okay. I'll have to check that out. Thank you. Time for one more call, I think. Tom is with us in Shell Lake. Tom, hi.
Hi.
What did you play, Hello? Tom? Yep, you're on the air.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yep, go for it.
Yeah, so I teach high school, and the tradition up in Shell Lake High School is a bunch of us teachers – up until the pandemic, we played cribbage every day at lunch.
Cool. Did you play cribbage just with other teachers, or was this a family game for you too, Tom?
Not really a family game. My family's game is euchre. But every day at lunch, when you're a new teacher, They ask if you know how to play cribbage, and you sit down, and to be part of the group, you've got to play cribbage at lunch.
Fantastic. I love it. Thank you so much for sharing that. Thanks to everybody who called in. You can keep sharing your favorite card games. You can email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Thanks for the great stories. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7, Kate kicks off a series of interviews with candidates for Wisconsin's Superintendent of Public Instruction. That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news, and then President Biden began his term signing a whole bunch of executive actions. We'll talk to an expert on presidential orders about how they've been used over time and why they don't allow a president to do everything they might want to. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.